The call sounds ordinary. A parent asks a question. The answer comes back calm, rehearsed, priced. There is no talk of grades, no talk of merit, just numbers and timing. A photo can be staged. A resume can be fixed. A coach can be paid. The voice on the line promises access where doors are supposed to stay closed. Behind the call sits a system built to look clean. Bribes are dressed up as donations. Lies are filed as athletic records. Universities market fairness while a side door stays unlocked for those who know where to knock. Each favor moves quietly, shielded by money, trust, and the belief that no one is watching, but someone is listening. Federal agents record the calls, bank transfers leave trails, false achievements pile up. What looks like ambition is something else entirely, a market, a shortcut, a crime that turns higher education into a transaction and leaves real students paying the price. Chapter 1, The Quiet Shortcut. The phone calls did not sound criminal. They sounded careful. Calm voices, short sentences. Parents asked what could be done. The answer came back measured and confident. There was always a way. It depended on the school. It depended on the risk. It depended on how much they were willing to spend. Federal agents recorded those calls in the months leading up to March 12, 2019. By then, investigators already understood the pattern. Families with money were not asking how to improve grades or applications. They were asking how to bypass them. The fixer offered solutions that never touched classrooms. Athletics, testing, paperwork, all of it could be arranged. At the center of the scheme was a private college admissions consultant operating out of California. He positioned himself as a guide through a brutal system. Behind closed doors, he sold something else. Access. His pitch was simple. Elite universities trusted athletic departments. Coaches had discretion. A coach's endorsement could override weak academics. All that endorsement required was a believable sport and a payment large enough to justify the risk. The fixer did not approach admissions offices directly. He went to coaches in so-called non-revenue sports: rowing, sailing, water polo, soccer, sports with small rosters and limited oversight. These programs did not draw television contracts or crowds. They did draw administrative trust. When a coach flagged an applicant as a recruit, the file moved differently. Questions softened, deadlines bent. To make the recruits look real, the fixer built fake athletic profiles. Photographs were staged. Teenagers posed on rowing machines they had never trained on. Their faces were cropped onto stock images of competitions. Stats were invented, heights adjusted, experience inflated. In some cases, students were listed for sports they had never played at any level. Those profiles went into official application packets. They carried the weight of a coach's word. Admissions officers assumed the athlete would fill a roster spot. Few asked why the recruit never contacted the team. Fewer still checked game footage. The process was designed on trust. The scheme fed on that trust. Money moved quietly. Parents did not write checks to coaches. They donated to a charitable foundation controlled by the fixer. On paper, the payments looked like philanthropy: college counseling for underserved students, scholarships, outreach. In reality, the funds were laundered bribes. Portions went to coaches, portions went to testing administrators. The fixer kept a cut. The charity issued receipts that allowed some parents to claim tax deductions. The amounts varied: a few $100,000 for mid-tier private schools, more for elite institutions with single-digit acceptance rates. The fixer explained the pricing during calls. He described risk levels. He described what could be guaranteed and what could not. He never promised admission outright. He promised influence. In the recorded calls, parents nodded verbally. They understood the language. The operation stretched across state lines: California, Massachusetts, Texas, New York. Students applied to universities they had never visited. Coaches they had never met vouched for them. In some cases, the students themselves did not know the full details. Parents handled the calls. Parents handled the money. The children showed up for photo shoots and test days and trusted the adults. Standardized testing offered another route. For students whose applications could not support even a fake athletic profile, the fixer arranged cheating. Test proctors were paid to correct answers after the fact. In other cases, imposters took exams in place of students. These actions were riskier. The fixer treated them as add-ons. He warned parents about exposure. Some still agreed. Investigators later said the calls revealed the mindset. Parents spoke openly about fear of rejection, about legacy expectations, about reputation. They did not describe desperation. They described entitlement. The idea that money should smooth the path felt normal to them. Higher education was framed as a transaction, not an evaluation. The investigation moved quietly. Agents tracked bank transfers. They matched payments to application cycles. They compared athletic rosters to incoming classes. Patterns emerged. Students listed as recruits never joined teams. Coaches accepted money around the same time admissions decisions were finalized. The data lined up. Wiretaps captured more than logistics. They captured tone. The fixer reassured parents when anxiety spiked. He reminded them how often the plan worked. He warned them not to discuss details over email. He coached them on what to tell their children. The calls showed intent. They showed knowledge. They showed planning. By early 2019, prosecutors believed they had enough. The scope was national. The conduct crossed multiple federal statutes: fraud, bribery, conspiracy. The evidence included recorded calls, emails, falsified records, and financial trails. The case did not hinge on one school or one coach. It described a system. On the morning of March 12, 2019, federal agents executed coordinated arrests. Doors were knocked on in wealthy neighborhoods. Some parents were taken into custody before their children left for school. Others surrendered later that day. News alerts broke while campuses were in session. The story moved fast once it broke. Names surfaced. Charges followed. The first chapter of the case was not about verdicts. It was about access. A quiet shortcut built into a trusted process. A belief that the rules were flexible if the price was right. Investigators said the damage went beyond individual admissions decisions. It struck at confidence in fairness itself. As the charging documents were unsealed, one question hung over the case. If this many people were willing to pay, and this many professionals were willing to accept the money, how much of the system had been compromised before anyone started listening? Chapter 2, The Mechanism. Once the arrests made the headlines, investigators shifted from exposure to explanation. The public saw celebrity names and elite schools. Prosecutors focused on structure. This was not a loose collection of favors. It was a system with defined roles, predictable flows, and safeguards built to avoid detection. At the center sat the admissions fixer. He did not invent the pressure. He monetized it. Parents came to him because he spoke the language of fear and reassurance. He framed the process as guidance. He framed the payments as strategy. But behind that language was a pipeline designed to convert cash into admissions leverage. The first link in the chain was identification. Parents reached out directly or were referred through private counselors and social networks. Initial conversations stayed vague. The fixer asked about target schools. He asked about grades and test scores, only to assess how much work the scheme would require. Weak academics meant higher risk and higher cost. Strong academics meant fewer steps. Once the scope was set, the fixer chose a route. Athletics was the preferred path. It carried institutional credibility and required minimal verification. The fixer maintained a network of coaches across multiple universities. These were not head coaches of high-profile programs. They were assistants or heads of niche sports. Their leverage was quiet but effective. The coach's role was simple: flag the applicant as a recruit, add the name to an internal list. In some cases, submit a short endorsement memo. That endorsement triggered a different review track inside admissions. Files marked as athletic recruits moved faster. They were reviewed with the assumption that roster needs justified flexibility. The fixer handled the paperwork. Fake athletic profiles were assembled to match the sport. For rowing, height and reach were emphasized. For soccer, endurance and club experience. For sailing, access to coastal training. The details varied, but the goal was the same: plausibility. Enough surface credibility to avoid questions. Photographs were critical. Parents were instructed to send casual images. The fixer's team altered them. Backgrounds were replaced. Faces were cropped and overlaid onto images pulled from competitions. In some cases, students posed on equipment for the sole purpose of documentation. These images entered official university files. Payments followed a strict script. Parents donated to the fixer's foundation. The language of charity provided cover. The fixer advised parents not to discuss the payments with schools or accountants beyond what was necessary. Some parents were told the donations could be deducted. Others were warned not to push their luck. From the foundation, money was dispersed in increments. Coaches received payments disguised as consulting fees or program support. Test administrators were paid in cash or through intermediaries. The fixer kept detailed internal records. Spreadsheets tracked clients, schools, amounts, and timelines. Those records later became evidence. Standardized test cheating ran parallel to the athletic pipeline. This route was used when admissions offices demanded minimum scores or when parents wanted extra insurance. The fixer coordinated with test site supervisors willing to look away or intervene. In some cases, students were placed in private rooms under the pretense of accommodations. Once the test ended, answers were altered. Proctors erased wrong responses and filled in correct ones. The fixer warned parents that this method carried greater exposure. He charged accordingly. The calls showed that parents understood the risk and accepted it. Inside universities, warning signs appeared. Some admission staff questioned recruits who never contacted teams. Some athletic departments noticed roster lists growing beyond capacity. Emails flagged concerns. But those concerns stalled. Trust in coaches overrode doubt. No central system cross-checked participation after enrollment. Investigators later described this as compartmentalization. Each participant saw only their part. Coaches did not handle payments directly. Admissions officers did not verify athletic claims. Parents did not interact with schools beyond the application. The fixer coordinated the whole without drawing attention. Wiretaps captured how openly the fixer discussed these gaps. He explained which schools required more cover and which asked fewer questions. He advised parents on behavior after acceptance. Decline interviews. Avoid team contact. Fade quietly into the student body. The goal was to leave no footprint. As the investigation widened, prosecutors debated scope. The evidence pointed to dozens of parents and multiple institutions. The question was whether to frame the case as individual fraud or as a systemic breach. They chose both. Charging documents detailed personal actions while describing a broader marketplace. The indictment language focused on conspiracy. Each act supported the others. The fixer coordinated, parents funded, coaches enabled, test administrators altered results. No single action stood alone. Together, they undermined admissions processes designed to evaluate merit and need. The public narrative often centered on wealth and privilege. Investigators emphasized intent. Recorded calls removed ambiguity. Parents discussed their children's limitations. They acknowledged deception. They asked how to avoid detection. This was not misunderstanding. It was planning. As evidence accumulated, prosecutors prepared for resistance. Some parents would argue they were misled. Some would claim ignorance of specific acts. The recordings contradicted those defenses. They showed awareness of fake profiles. They showed agreement to payments tied to outcomes. By the time indictments were authorized, the case had shifted from surprise to inevitability. The structure was clear. The mechanisms were mapped. What remained uncertain was impact. How many students were displaced? How many decisions were altered? Those questions would not be fully answered in court. What investigators knew was simpler. The system worked because it exploited trust. It sold certainty in a process defined by uncertainty. And for years, it operated in plain sight, protected by money, silence, and the assumption that elite institutions were immune to this kind of fraud. Chapter 3. The courtroom was quieter than the headlines. Parents sat beside attorneys. Some avoided the cameras. Others stared straight ahead. The charging documents had already done the damage. Names were public. Methods were exposed. What remained was accountability. As cases moved forward, prosecutors laid out the evidence in plain terms: recorded calls, financial records, fabricated athletic profiles. Each defendant faced the same core allegation. They knowingly paid bribes and participated in fraud to secure university admission. In several cases, parents entered guilty pleas. In open court, they acknowledged what they had done. They admitted intent. Judges did not treat the cases as victimless. During hearings, they spoke about fairness and trust. College admissions, they said, rely on integrity. When that integrity is compromised, the harm spreads. Every false recruit displaced someone else. Every altered test score pushed another applicant down the list. The victims were unnamed but real. Universities responded quickly in public statements. They expressed shock. They promised cooperation. Some terminated or suspended coaches. Others launched internal reviews. Admissions offices revised procedures. Athletic departments tightened oversight. These actions were presented as reform. Critics questioned how much had changed. Internal investigations revealed gaps that had existed for years. Non-revenue sports often operated with minimal scrutiny. Admissions offices relied heavily on coach endorsements. Follow-up checks after enrollment were rare. Once a student arrived on campus, questions stopped. The system assumed honesty. For legitimate student athletes, the fallout was personal. Some learned they had been cut to make room for recruits who never intended to compete. Others realized they had lost scholarships or roster spots to applicants who paid their way in. Their frustration rarely made headlines. Their names were not released in court. The case also reshaped public perception. College admissions had long been criticized for inequity, legacy preferences, donor influence, expensive preparation. This scandal gave those criticisms a concrete shape. It showed how privilege could turn influence into outright fraud. The line between advantage and crime became visible. Sentencing varied. Some parents received prison time. Others received home confinement or probation. Fines were imposed. Restitution was ordered in certain cases. Judges weighed factors such as cooperation, prior records, and the scale of payments. No sentence erased the exposure. The fixer at the center of the scheme faced the most severe consequences. Prosecutors described him as the architect. He did not merely facilitate. He designed, he maintained the network, he profited from each transaction. In court filings, the government argued that without him, the conspiracy would not have existed. As cases concluded, attention shifted to prevention. Universities announced new verification steps for athletic recruits, random audits, post-enrollment participation checks, limits on coach discretion, testing agencies revised security protocols. These measures were presented as safeguards. Skeptics questioned whether reforms addressed the underlying demand. The pressure to gain admission to elite institutions had not eased. Acceptance rates remained low. Prestige still carried weight. Families with resources continued to seek advantages. The question was whether the system could distinguish legal leverage from illegal manipulation. Investigators acknowledged this tension. In interviews after sentencing, they said the case was never about eliminating inequality. It was about enforcing boundaries. Paying for tutoring was legal. Paying for fake athletes was not. The law drew that line clearly. The recordings showed it had been crossed. Years after the arrests, the scandal remained a reference point. It was cited in debates about admissions reform. It appeared in training materials for university staff. It was taught as a case study in ethics courses. Its name became shorthand for corruption dressed as ambition. For the students admitted through fraud, consequences varied. Some remained enrolled, others transferred or withdrew. Universities handled these cases quietly. Public statements emphasized individual review. The institutions avoided broad declarations. The focus stayed on policy, not punishment. The most lasting cost was intangible. Trust eroded. Applicants questioned whether fairness existed at all. Families wondered what was hidden behind rejection letters. Universities faced skepticism when defending their processes. The idea of merit had been damaged. In the end, the case did not reveal a single flaw. It revealed a market, a demand for certainty in an uncertain system, a willingness to exploit trust when oversight was weak. Prosecutors closed their files, courts issued sentences, universities rewrote policies. What remained was the knowledge that the quiet shortcut had worked. Not once, not accidentally, but repeatedly across institutions that prided themselves on excellence. The scandal ended one operation. It did not end the pressure that made it possible.